Welcome to Perspectives on Prevention, the podcast series from the Prevention and Early Intervention Network, where we talk with people about intervening early and preventing difficulties arising for children, families, and communities. This episode of Perspectives on Prevention focuses on the justice system. I talk with Judge Michael White, Chair of the Parole Board, about missed opportunities and how we can do better in the lives of vulnerable young people. Welcome to this episode of Perspectives on Prevention, in which I'm delighted to be speaking with Judge Michael White, who has had a very long history in criminal law, starting in his hometown of Carndonagh in Donegal, and then moving to Dublin, where he has been involved in defence work over a number of years, particularly focusing on communities and populations of disadvantage. Became a circuit court judge and then a high court judge in 2011, which obviously brought him into a very different realm of criminal justice. And whilst Michael has recently retired in his judicial capacity, he continues to provide a service to the state. He's the chair of the Statutory Parole Board and is also currently chairing a commission investigation into a paedophile case. So, Michael, I'm delighted to meet you. So maybe just let's start by talking about how you came to be focused on disadvantage and populations that are vulnerable. Where did that interest come from?
Yeah, well, there was a movement in the 70s, early 70s, people who were interested in using law as more a public service rather than making money. And it developed in the UK and in the United States. There was the storefront lawyer movement, which focused on developing legal services for marginalized communities. And then in the United Kingdom, it was the Legal Action Group. And there was a lot of work done in advancing, for example, collective legal action to improve people's lives, and I became interested in that in UCD when I started there in 1970, and it really developed into a lifelong interest.
And so tell me about some of the organisations or some of the kind of causes, if you like, that have kind of been close to your heart over the course of your career.
Generally in the civil liberties area, the advancement of legal aid for communities who want access to justice, the importance of access to justice, the importance of the rule of law and democracy and independence of the judiciary, and that people have an opportunity to have their rights vindicated and that life is fair to them, basically.
And where do you think that the Irish sort of justice system is now on a continuum of offering all of that to people or people not having access? Where do you think we stand at the moment?
We certainly made huge progress over my lifetime. I think in an age of instant news, it's very hard sometimes to take stock, but certainly over my lifetime, in terms of legislation, in terms of multi-agency approach, in terms of new ideas, there's been huge improvement over a period of 40 or 50 years since I became a student activist. Yeah.
Well, how has the, you called it the age of instant media, I think. How does that impact on the court system in particular? So, you know, when you've got a jury and so on, how do you think we can manage that?
I think the way that you have to avoid impact on it is short-term solutions. All the time, and you have to, and I think it's very much part of what you were involved in prevention and diversion. In an era of instant news, you're reacting immediately to the crisis that's present or the particular case that you're doing, but it's also important to sit back and try and develop longer term or medium term solutions, because it's certainly in my experience that those decisions that are taken, which will have an impact on the medium or long term, are really to the better advantage of people. If you're making instant decisions, reacting, sometimes the decision making isn't good.
So let's think about those medium and more long term solutions. And obviously the focus for our listeners is about prevention and early intervention. So thinking about, I don't know, probably hundreds of people who've come before you as both a circuit court and a high court judge on criminal charges, and knowing as we do that disadvantaged populations are overrepresented in the criminal justice system, in prisons and so on, when you look at the people who've come before you, been sentenced, found guilty, whatever, have there been sort of patterns, themes? Have you sometimes thought, if only somebody had intervened, if only this piece had been different in this person's life? What have those themes been for you?
Yes, well, obviously there's certain types of crime that's very focused on marginalized areas. Sexual violence can go right through the communities and social classes, domestic violence, obviously corruption and that type of crime. The biggest focus for me is, and really the concentrating theme, is when it comes to me in the criminal justice system, in many cases it's too late. People are in a pattern of criminal behavior and it's very difficult to divert them. And obviously the type of cases that I was involved in were very serious crimes where there had to be a sentence of imprisonment imposed. But I think it's important never to give up hope on people, because clearly underprivilege plays a huge part in someone developing antisocial tendencies. And I always try to look at it from this perspective. If a child cannot choose their parents or the community that they're brought up in, what are a child's needs? It's nurture, care, love, education, health, and a future opportunity. And a lot of the children that developed into adults that came before the courts that I presided over, didn't have those opportunities. I always remember a psychiatrist and an evidence before me saying, even if you have one good parent, you're lucky. So, if you're brought up in a family which there's major social problems already of drug addiction, alcohol abuse, dysfunctional parenting, then the child is on a difficult pathway. I think we always have to be optimistic that pathway can change. And I think early diversion and the work done by organizations and communities and where they have resources to deal with it is hugely important, because, if you take cross-section of 10 children, if you can divert even 3 or 4 of those into a pathway of more progressive behavior and that they fulfill their ambitions, it's all to the good. And I'm a great believer in cross-fertilization and cross-agency support. The courts have their job to do, which is quite narrow. People are prosecuted for a crime and you hear the evidence and you have to deal with it. But the multi-agency approach in marginalized communities, to me, is very important. And the work done by various agencies, from the local authority, the Garda Síochána, the probation service, charities, and the communities themselves, the resources that they bring to bear on their own organizations.
Would you have seen examples where that's worked well, or have you a sense of because it doesn't, we all know that it doesn't always work well. It's not, we can't take for granted that people will work together effectively. So
yeah, I've seen it work very well in community addiction programs, drug and alcohol issues, where there's a window of opportunity for an offender, and where there are locally resourced groups that are dealing with drug addiction and alcohol addiction, and also giving wider educational support. And obviously in a more serious crime, it's difficult to build it in, but sometimes you can give a part suspended sentence or a fully suspended sentence where there's conditions attached to the person dealing with the issues which are confronting that individual. Just in my own experience, I found it, say, young men, particularly between the age of 14 and 22, who had got involved in antisocial behavior, it was very difficult to divert them during that age period for some reason. This is my own experience, but sometimes in their 20s, either they meet a girlfriend or they have a child or something, and there's a window of opportunity then that they want to change their behavior and that they're interested actually in doing something about it and that they're proactive in taking steps. And that's a window of opportunity for the courts and the agencies to help those people.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've heard other people say similar things that, you know, finding often for men more than women, it's sort of an external influencer, whereas for women, it kind of is generally more internal that they want to make the change themselves. You've mentioned diversion a few times, Michael, so I'm sure most people listening will be aware of the juvenile diversion program that's now very well established and where young people can be cautioned. And then also we have, it's had various iterations, but the youth diversion projects that are in a lot of communities around the country. So would you have any sense of how they work? Would you have seen people coming through the courts who've been involved in the community-based diversion or who've been cautioned? What's your sense of that kind of aspect of the work?
Yeah, I think that's very important. I mean, the community policing project and diversion programs. I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of work done on policing, and primary role of policing is to prevent antisocial behaviour and to detect crime. But police services and obviously our own Garda Síochána are very conscious of working in communities, which is a challenge because obviously where there's high levels of deprivation and antisocial behaviour, communities have to be protected. I think that's something we lose sight of, that the marginalised communities deserve a very good police service because they are the communities most affected by antisocial behaviour. You know, the drug gangs preying on young people, you know, vandalism of community property. So I'm a great believer that these areas should never be neglected or abandoned. I think there was sometimes a philosophy to that extent that what can you do? But when you invest resources in marginalized communities and where the agencies, including those responsible for law and order, engage at constructive ways of looking at it, it certainly has helped. So the whole juvenile liaison officer system in the Gardaí, community policing, community service, those, in my view, have been positive contributions along the way.
Michael, in recent weeks, there's been some debate on the airwaves about restorative justice, restorative approaches. So I'm thinking particularly about the abuse allegations at Black Rock College and you know, the approach that's being taken there. What's your sense of restorative approaches and the role that they can play in the criminal justice system?
I think it's very difficult. An area of major interest to me is also the victims of crime. And there's been huge efforts. Originally, they were really never involved in the criminal justice system. If you were a victim, you were called as a witness. And I think both the Oireachtas and various governments and the courts have become more conscious that they were being left out of the system. So empathy towards victims is hugely important in the criminal justice system by way of victim impact statements, allowing the victim to give evidence of the effects of the crimes upon them. Restorative justice is, I think it's very difficult, certainly in terms of extreme violence or sexual violence at the extreme end or extreme physical violence, it is difficult. In more summary offences, it can play a much more constructive part. It can work, but I'm not so sure in cases of extreme sexual violence and physical violence that the contact of the victim with the perpetrator is something that's beneficial to the victim. Certainly in more minor crimes, antisocial crimes, minor assaults, economic crimes, yes, but extreme violence, that's my personal opinion, I don't think it works too well because of the huge impact of extreme violence on victims. I mean, it's very hard to describe how their lives are shattered by either extreme physical and also, child sexual violence and adult sexual violence.
And obviously there's been quite a focus on enabling victims to, I suppose, inform the justice system with, I think there's been some European legislation, hasn't there, around kind of the involvement
of victims. There's been victims legislation which has been implemented in Ireland about the right of victims to be given information and to be part of the system. And obviously, under the new Parole Act as well, which I'm dealing with as chair, for the first time now, victims have a say in the system. They have to be interviewed and their views taken in relation to an application for parole. So it has become much more central in the criminal justice system, and not before time.
Yeah. And so that, I mean, that's obviously really positive. I'm thinking about criticisms of the justice system, particularly from people who've experienced sexual violence and those who work with them, where victims would say that they feel re-traumatized by the experience of the justice system. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult area. I was influenced a lot personally. My late wife, Dr. Maud McKee, she was a doctor and psychotherapist, was a pioneer in issues of sexual violence. She was a founder of the Sexual Assault Treatment Unit in the Rotunda and CARI, the Children's Sexual Violence Charity, and also she was a member of the Rape Crisis Board for a number of years. So the interaction with victims of sexual violence in the courts has been difficult. I mean, obviously, you have to weigh that up in terms of the rights of an accused person to a fair trial, a conviction for a serious sexual crime. The consequences for an accused person are highly consequential. I mean, a prison sentence and a lifelong membership or establishment on the sexual offences register will occur. But there's no doubt that people who have given evidence in rape trials have found themselves re-traumatized by the whole experience. It's very difficult. And I think one very difficult area for people who allege sexual crimes is the whole disclosure issue. Some people who, and I've witnessed this myself as a judge, feel that they've been traumatized by an accused person getting access to highly confidential, personalized information in relation, for example, to counseling and things like that, which I know is a huge issue for people who are in the who are witnesses in the criminal justice system alleging serious sexual violence. So there's been huge improvements during my period of a judge. Judges are very sensitive to the issue. There's been a lot more training. We're a lot more conscious of respect for those who give evidence while respecting the rights of accused persons. And then in terms of support persons who come into court, victims organizations and things like that, there's been a huge amount of work done in the court service to facilitate that. So, I mean, behind the scenes, there's been a huge amount of work done. And I think sometimes judges have, a lot of the work sometimes is unappreciated, but I mean, there's a great effort to make the system much more adept at dealing with sexual violence trials, but you can't eliminate the trauma completely. It's a traumatic experience for people to give evidence of alleged horrific crimes upon them.
Yeah. Michael, I'm curious, you've mentioned a number of things that to me sound like a really fine balancing act. So, you know, being respectful of the victim and at the same time ensuring that people have a fair trial. What makes a good judge and how do we know we have one?
The interesting thing I found when I was made a judge is that it's very different from practice. And to me, a good judge is that you have to become a good listener, know when to intervene and when not to intervene, and always be respectful, you know, don't be rude. I mean, I think it's a stressful job and sometimes you can lose your temper. It's very important to be respectful to the witnesses, the litigants, the lawyers, and yet at the same time, be firm when you have to be, because, you know, some people mess up the system, you know, adjournments, not having their work done on time. So I think key elements are respect, fairness, firmness, and also being civil and doing your job in a civil way, and appreciating that sometimes you can lose your temper. And if you do lose your temper and it's your fault, you should apologize and say, look, I shouldn't have done that.
What were the things in your time as a circuit court judge and a high court judge? What were the things that used to kind of, what were your triggers? What did you get very impatient about?
Well, I got impatient about people who hadn't their cases prepared properly and at the very last minute would come in and court time been booked and look for adjournments, or they haven't got this report or that report. That kind of basic messing, I suppose, frustrated me. And obviously I tried to tolerate it as best I could. I didn't want to do an injustice to anyone by not adjourning the case, but that was issues that I got frustrated about. And then sometimes, you know, a very small minority of lawyers would behave badly, become overly aggressive or rude or that. And obviously you have to engage with that as well. Now, my experience of advocates generally was an excellent one, those were my trigger points. And I hope I was respectful and courteous, but certainly there were some times that the odd time anyway I lost my temper about things like that. Yeah.
I want to go back to the window of opportunities and the medium to long-term solutions, Michael. So you talked about what children need, so you nurture, love, health, education, and so on. From where you've sat, so we can think about prevention and early intervention on a continuum, and you know where we intervene. Obviously, you're at one end of that continuum. You know, you're at the point where, as you said yourself, maybe it's too late, that it's really hard to kind of affect change. If you were to think back to the people who've presented in front of you in the courts, and you think about where that window of opportunity was, where some intervention could have been made that may have changed that person's trajectory, what are there any themes that have emerged for you?
Educational opportunity. I think that when you have a situation where the nuclear family isn't working and where a child is really at risk, they're not getting the nurture and care that they need, and obviously there's issues of poverty and economic opportunity, etc. A huge resource is the preschool and primary school system. I think that's a huge area where we could do an awful lot more. I mean, the resources put into the JESH schools, I think, had huge positive outcomes, where some children were fed at school. You had little homework programs. I think if you can get the community resource to take over, I mean, it's not a substitute for good parenting or where problems arise, but it certainly has, if it can be identified early that there are problems, you know. And of course, these communities have to be resourced to do that. You know, you need the district nurses coming in, you need the health visitors, you need the resources in the schools to be able to help people who are disadvantaged. Because I suppose one of the biggest things that I saw over the years were lost lives. I mean, a lot of people who, both in terms of the impact on victims of violent crime and the impact of that, but also the impact of people, the perpetrators. I mean, certainly in some of the cases, you felt that they could have led productive lives and went down a wrong channel. And the influence of these drug gangs now on marginalized communities is terrible. And I mean, these people are just operating cynically for profit. And, when young people are developing drug debts, and I mean, that resource of trying to deal with that scourge is so important. But if I was looking at a major help in terms of diversion in children, I would look to the community organizations that help the children, and also the local school system, the preschool system and the primary, particularly that preschool and primary. And if government and people who are interested in improving the lives of people in marginalized communities, investment in those areas. And I mean, there has to be, without financial resources put into them, it doesn't work. You have to resource these communities to be able to divert people from antisocial behaviour.
And Michael, you mentioned earlier that disadvantaged communities experienced the impact of crime and antisocial behaviour far more than others. Yeah. And that they deserve to be safe and to be protected. And obviously, you know, in mentioning sort of the impact of gangs and drug use and so on, that, you know, that brings a whole range of really, you know, potentially very traumatic experiences to a community. What are the things, are there any practical things that you think you'd like to see more of in order to improve the sense of safety and protectedness in a community?
Well, there was a phrase that was introduced, in fact, by Tony Blair when he came into government in 1997, tough on crime and the causes of crime. I think one without the other is insufficient. You have to be tough on crime, on the drug gangs and the way they prey on vulnerable communities. But you also have to look at the causes of crime and always be optimistic. Never abandon marginalized communities. And that, to me, would be the central issue. I mean, even simple things like sweeping the streets and making sure that the environment is good and all that, that it doesn't deteriorate, you know, vandalized houses and parks not kept clean and leisure and facilities and sports facilities and all that. Those are so important in terms of communities. I coached a lot of children's soccer when I was younger, and a little young team coming from the area that I lived in. But we used to go out to play soccer in the marginalized communities, and the amount of work done by these football clubs and, you know, all the sports, Gaelic, rugby, soccer, was huge. I mean, the amount of voluntary work that people do to try and divert young kids into a more positive way of life. I'm always optimistic about the human spirit in terms of what we can achieve. I mean, sometimes we get pessimistic and overwhelmed, but I'm always amazed at the amount of time that people give up without thinking in terms of the time that they invest to try and help other people.
Well, on that note of optimism and never giving up, Judge Michael White, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Murray, and my pleasure as well. It really was interesting having a chat about it.
Thanks for listening to Perspectives on Prevention. We hope we've inspired you and given you something to think about. If you want to suggest someone for us to chat with, we'd love to hear from you. Just drop us an email at info@pein.ie.